accession number 11767, reel 4.
And he was extremely good, of course, of talking to the troops of whichever service he happened to be talking to at the time.
Now, did you have anything to do with the Korean War of 1950-53?
Yes, I did. I was appointed to command the straw. That was my first proper command, really. The other one, the brazen, in 1939, was purely acting and temporary. And in December 51, I was sent to the Far East to command a destroyer, Concord. And she was at Hong Kong when I joined. I went out in a troop ship and joined Concord at Hong Kong, and very shortly after that we sailed for Korean waters, because the Korean War was then on, and we went almost straight off, and we were at the British ships were based at Japanese port of Sasebo, where there was a very good harbour indeed. And then from there we would go up on patrol. The British had the west coast of Korea. The two coasts were divided. The Americans did the east coast, we did the west coast. And as far as the destroyers were concerned, our job was to escort the aircraft carrier during the day when they were flying. There wasn't night flying in those days. And we escorted the aircraft carrier. It was a war fought rather in accordance with the Queensberry rules, of course, in that we didn't actually have submarine or air attack. But, of course, we didn't know whether there would be or not at any time, so we always had to be prepared for it. And we were always screening the carrier against any chance of this. And we did this by day and by night. We went into the coast of Korea, and we would go up the rivers. There were one or two rivers which were big enough, and we would go up these, and we would anchor. And at certain intervals during the night, random intervals, of course, we would bombard. We couldn't, of course, see the results of our bombardment. All this, I should say, was north of the 38th parallel, which means that we were bombarding North Korea, of course. We would fire these shells, which, of course, the sailors liked doing, because they like firing shells. Obviously, that's what they joined for, really. And we would anchor. And before daylight, we would come out and go out to sea again and escort the aircraft carrier during the day. And we would do this, we would stay up there on patrol for whatever the period was, about 10 days or a fortnight. Of course, every now and then we refueled and reprovisioned from one of our auxiliaries, which was anchored off the coast. And then we would go back again to Sasebo for a little rest period, and then up again on patrol. And the same procedure happened. And every, I forget how often, perhaps about 4 months or so, we would go down to Hong Kong for a proper sort of rest and recreation period for 10 days or a fortnight. And the sailors could have proper rest then, and any repairs that had to be done were done. And then up to Japan again, and on up patrol, and so it went on with that sort of routine. Every now and then, we would do exchange from one coast to the other to pass under American control. And we all did this in turn, went up to the East Coast and came under American control, and did the same kind of thing up there, except there was more bombardment to be done. It was quite fun, really. We used to go and stop off the coast, very close inshore, and by certain bridges which we knew about, and watch for the trains to come out, and then fire at the trains, bombard the trains, because they were supplies. These were supplies going down to the troops at the front. And it was very, very exciting watching all this, watching the entrance or the exit to the bridge, to the tunnel, which were cut in the cliffside, for us then to try and hit the train.
Were they easy to hit?
Not very, no, because you had to be pretty quick, you know, and it wasn't all that easy to get the exact range and get the height exactly right. It's quite a small target, you know, and of course you wouldn't have very long to do it because it was travelling quite fast. I had, on one occasion, when I was operating up this American coast, I was in a little bay, and We did have various, or the Americans did in this case, but we also had the various agents and people ashore. And I was bombarding, which I couldn't see, I was bombarding a marshalling yard. And I was getting these reports by our sort of secret radio with this agent. And apparently we were doing some good, and we were rather doing some damage to the target when all of a sudden, they opened fire against us from shore. And this was difficult because they could see us, but we couldn't see them. You would just see a puff of smoke every now and then. And so this seemed to be rather a one-sided battle because I was locked into this bay, really, and couldn't move very much either way. So I'm afraid I turned and came out again rather quickly, but we did get hit. On my after gun, and two of my sailors, I'm sorry to say, were killed. And then on another occasion, when I was up this coast with the Americans, one of the American ships was hit from a shore battery doing a bombardment, and they were hit in the stern, and they were obviously in trouble, and I was fairly close at the time, so I went over and was able to go between them and the shore battery that was bombarding them, and together we weaved about, and on that occasion I didn't get hit, and they didn't get hit anymore. But I had to escort them back some of the way because they had this hole in the stern. They weren't quite certain what was going to happen because we had to go slowly to keep the stern up and not down, which is where it goes when you go faster. Normally we did use a lot of high speed, of course.
Were there ever any surface attacks on the Concorde?
No. Only attacks I had, as I say, there weren't any aircraft or submarines which came, and the only attacks that I had was this one shore battery which opened up on me when I had been doing this bombardment for a little time and didn't, of course, know it was there. The only other damage I had was, I think, one of the little South Korean gunboats ran into my stern when it was trying to come alongside and pushed a hole through me, but that was the only other actual damage that we had. We had some quite severe weather conditions too. Compete with it, because it's very cold in the winter up there, and we did have ice, and we were always conscious of the fact that we would have to be very careful, because we were operating up these estuaries and inshore, and the last thing we wanted was to get stuck in by ice, which would have been possible if we hadn't been careful there. And then of course we would have been easy prey, because they did lob shells at us from the shore every now and then.
What about the Suez Crisis?
So is I was chief of staff in 1956 to the admiral who was second in command of the Mediterranean fleet, and this was Admiral Danforth Slater, and we were visiting Alexandria in, I think it was June of 56, and I can remember the evening very well. I was going ashore to meet some people whom I'd met who were going to take me out to dinner, and as far as I remember, we then went on to some nightclub. And on the way out to meet them, I passed through the square where NASA was going to make a speech that evening, and there were flags and chairs and everything ready, and people were beginning to gather, and there were loudspeakers, and I could see the press beginning to gather and things. And anyway, he was due to make this big speech, and I went on my way to these friends, and they took me out to this nightclub place. And while we were there, towards the end of the evening, as far as we were concerned, we were told that NASA's speech that he made in the square, which I just passed through, that he had nationalized the canal. Well, this was rather a worry to me because I wasn't quite sure what was going to happen to us. Anyway, I went on and spent the night with these people and then went back first thing to the ship in the morning, and nobody knew what was going to happen. Of course, I was with a cotton man, and of course this could be the end of his time out in Alexandria too. And anyway, the ship happily was still there when I got back in the morning, and we were then told to sail. We asked to stay there because we felt that, I mean, we just made a signal to the Admiralty and said that our recommendation would be to remain for a short time anyway to see what was going to happen and give comfort to the British community in Alexandria. Anyway, we were told to sail and proceed to Cyprus. And we felt rather sad, Rado, because there was 30 or 40 of the British community waving us goodbye, and we felt that we were rather deserting them in their predicament. You know, but anyway, we went to Cyprus. We were then told that the Admiral and certain officers of his staff, which we would choose, that's all the operational officers, would be required to fly to London at once and start planning for an operation. And so we got an aeroplane in Cyprus and flew via Malta, which was our base, just to see our commander-in-chief on the way. And we flew to London, and there the next morning we had an interview with Admiral Mountbatten, who was at that time First Sea Lord, and he told us that the evening before he'd been one of his very rare visits to the Savoy, and while he was there he was sent for by the Prime Minister, who was Anthony Eden, and the other Chief of Staff were also sent for too, and they were told to prepare an operation to land and capture the Suez Canal. And so we had this briefing, and we then went this time, not this time to Norfolk House, but to another annex of the War Office, where we started planning with the Army and the Air Force for landing. Our original plan was to land at Alexandria, and then that was changed, and we were to land at Port Said. And so, for the next 2 months or so, we made various plans, which had to be altered for various reasons, some political, some military. And towards the end of the initial planning stage, which I suppose was perhaps in September 56, we were told to put the operation on ice, as it were, and just to keep at short notice for the operation. And so we sat there and went on planning with the various changes that we were told to make, without any date, of course, at that time in mind for any operation, because you will recall there were a lot of problems with the whole operation and as to whether it could take place and when it might take place, and there were all these alternative plans going on with the Americans. Foster Dulles, I remember, was the Secretary of State at the time, and then there were all sorts of organizations. Mr. Menzies came from Australia, I remember, and they had the Canal Users Association, and all kinds of alternative ideas were put forward, and we went on planning. Sometimes we were told to do this, and sometimes we were told to do that. But anyway, finally, after a long pause and a great many delays, we carried out the landings at Portside after a period of bombing by the Royal Air Force. There was a little opposition from the shore, but nothing very big. Most of it sort of rifle fire or something like that. And we landed. In our case, it was a question of landing the army and also helicoptering in. First time helicopters were used in assault amphibious operations. The Marine commandos from two commando carriers, which we had with us, the Albion and the Bulwark. And we landed, and then I was in the headquarters ship, the Tyne. As I say, the Admiral's Chief of Staff. And then the Admiral went in with the Army Chief of Staff, General Stockwell, and the Air Commander, Marshal Barnett. And they went in the boat that we sent them in to the harbour at Portside, and they went alongside, and people started firing at them. And my Admiral turned to the General and said, "I don't think they're ready for us yet, General." And anyway, they didn't go ashore. The Admiral then came back in the boat with the Air Marshal, and finally the General, whom General Stockwell, he went off with his troops, of course, and we were very worried as to how or when he was going to come back, because it got dark. And then we moved in, and we were alongside in Portside on, I think it was the first evening. I remember being at dinner in the Admiral's cabin when my signal officer brought a signal in to me, or message from the Marine Commando General ashore, which said, "I have just heard on the BBC that we are to cease fire at midnight. Request instructions," you see. This, in fact, was the first that we had heard of this, although it came through pretty quickly after this from our General Supreme Commander. And I remember General Stockwell getting up from the table like a flash and said to his Chief of Staff to make a signal to his troops ashore to advance as far and as fast as they could up to midnight. And then we stopped. They got as far as El Cap, and that was the end of that. And you remember this was caused by the threat to the pound from America, Eisenhower on the phone to Eden. And we then sat in Portside waiting and wondering what was going to happen. We were told not to clear the block ships, and not to do anything harder until the United Nations arrived. And we had landed at the beginning of November and in the middle of December, just over a month later, we sailed. We in our headquarters ship, HMS Tyne, we were the last to leave port side, and we sailed, leaving these United Nations people in control. They had to clear the block ships, which we'd been told not to do. In fact, when I say we're the last ship to leave, there was one ship that left after us, which was a destroyer. And you may remember there was an army lieutenant called Morehouse who'd been kidnapped and possibly murdered, but we didn't know. There was always hope that he was still alive. And I was asked by the army chief of staff shortly before we left whether I could arrange for a destroyer to be very close to a certain berth, because it was just a chance that this lieutenant would be brought down to the jetty. If he was alive, they had had some secret message. And so this destroyer waited, as had been instructed, until a certain hour after dark that night. But I'm afraid there was no sign of Lieutenant Morehouse. So they sailed and joined us, and we sailed back to Malta, and that was the end of the operation as far as we were concerned, but all the rest of it is political history, of course.
Was there a feeling of bitterness at the stopping of the operation?
Yes, I think perhaps I would say more sadness, certainly. Great sadness. There had been great frustration for a long time, because one... all our time, not only towards the end of the time in London, but even when we were in Port Said. I mean, in the same day, we'd been told once to advance and then to withdraw. So there was great frustration as to what was going on, but we gradually got used to all this, and you know, we laughed and we had to treat it almost as a joke sometimes, rather, because there was so much order and... counter-order, but I don't know whether there was bitterness by this time. I suppose we were resigned to almost anything.
When the planning was being done for the operation, had it seemed easy to capture the canal?
It's a very good question that you ask this, of course, because the point was... The military objective at any given time was always very uncertain. Eden's declared intention, you will remember, was to topple Nasser, whatever that means. And there's no doubt that we could have captured the canal if we'd been allowed to go on and do it, because we had a reasonable force, and of course our troops were undoubtedly better than the Egyptian troops for what we were trying to do. There's no doubt in my mind that we could have captured the canal, but what then was the unanswered question always.